I would like to introduce our first speaker, Gene.
I'm an addict. My name is Gene. I'm not quite sure when I said I was going to do this workshop, because I have an opportunity to travel a lot, and so I get a lot of phone calls, and I get asked by a lot of people, and I always say yes, and I always tell them I don't want to know what the workshop's on, simply because I'm obsessive, compulsive, unbelievably in some other dimension. And if I know what the workshop's about, I will spend just this huge amount of time planning it and thinking about it and reading and looking at the book. In this case, I'm glad I didn't know what the workshop was about until yesterday, because I would have gone through all of our literature and I wouldn't have found that I know of any reference to global recovery in any of them, which would have confused me and made my drive here a lot more difficult than it was. I heard yesterday, and the very first thing that jumped into my head was, global means the world, and therefore I'm supposed to come up here and share with you for a half hour on all the places that I've gone outside the United States. And at some point during whatever it is I'm going to say, I'm sure that I'll refer to them, because every one of them, just like every convention I've had the opportunity to have been to, and there's been a few hundred, has given me something new. But I don't think that that's what's meant by global recovery. To an extent, I think it is. But the fact of the matter is that a topic such as this in our fellowship would include members who, for one reason or another, are unable to travel, usually financially. It costs a lot of money. And as far as I know, there isn't anybody in the fellowship who has corporate sponsors who will fund them going to various places around the United States, although I would be willing to wear a decal for anybody if they pay for me to go wherever I chose to go. I think global means more than that, and I think each one of us has to define what global is. For me, global implies three different things. It implies those things that I can do and what part I play in them. It implies my support for something that, although it is a major part of what this fellowship is trying to do, it's not understood by a lot of people, and I'm referring to translations. And I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about them, because to me, because I've had the opportunity to see what translations can do, I consider them not only important, I consider them probably one of the two most important things in this fellowship, the other one being H&I. First of all, on a personal level, what global means to me, what I believe global needs to be to all of us, is what is your world comprised of? As I said, I've had the opportunity to travel in this year alone. I've been to 7 conventions. I can tell you without a doubt that every one of those conventions, although they all had Narcotics Anonymous as their core, every one of them were different. They were different in the people that were there. They were different in the level of knowledge. They were different in the amount of clean time. They were different in the length that they've been conventions. The fellowships where they're held are different. Some were extremely small. I was in a convention last week that their entire region doesn't even make up the number of people that are at this convention. Easily doesn't. Their yearly convention this year there was probably the biggest I've ever been to there, and I've been going to their convention, I think my first one was 11 years ago. And it may have comprised 500 people. I don't think so. I really don't think so. And that was the largest I've ever seen there. And what the term global recovery means to me in that context is that it's one thing for me to go to these different places. It's another thing for me to talk about recovery in my home group and in my region, and for me to take back what I see in their region. Size does not mean they're not doing wonderful things. You know, earlier, prior to starting this workshop, we got on a small discussion about traditions and tradition workshops. I was at a convention in January of this year that I don't believe has ever gone over 200 people, and yet the tradition workshop that I chaired had close to 80. It had probably a third of the convention at that particular workshop. I had people after the workshop asking me questions about what I said, information that I referred to. So size doesn't necessarily mean that the recovery is lacking in any way. So what I'm able to do and what I have done over the years is that I've had the opportunity, I shared with somebody earlier today, because one of my favorite things is talking. I love to talk. But I shared with him the fact that over the years, I was able to take the first revised new white book to Nebraska. I took the first Just for Today to Kansas. You have no idea what feeling that is. Something that we know. I, on a yearly basis and have for years, I go to the South Dakota and Nebraska conventions, for example, and I take literature with me because they don't have workshops. West of the Mississippi, there's only three of the 13 workshops in existence. There's one in Northern California, one in Southern California, and one in Texas. You get to Wyoming and South Dakota and Nebraska, their literature inventories, if they're able to have them, consist of basic text and step working guides and Just for Today's, white books, key tags, and medallions, and not that many medallions. I have been going to Nebraska with literature for 12 years. And in that 12 years, every year, I have had at least one person come up to me and pick up the introductory guide and say, when did we print this? They don't see that stuff. They don't see hardcover Just for Today's. They don't see handbooks. There are people every year. I just went to a convention in Kansas, which also doesn't have a service office. And although I know that it happens every year, they bought out every Guide to Local Service that I had. They bought out every Miracles Happen that I had. And they brought out every handbook that I had. They don't see this information. That's part of using my abilities to travel and the fact that I'm involved with one of the workshops in the United States and taking this information out to them. That's how our fellowship grew. In the beginning, for anybody who's had the opportunity to read, well, the one book that comes to mind that's most, I believe, is the most historical document we have or most related to history is My Years with Narcotics Anonymous. It's no longer in print. It was written by a non-addict who ran the service office after Jimmy Kay did. And what he did, he went into the archives. For those of you who ever, side story, I also do this a lot. For those of you who ever get the opportunity to go out to the World Service Office, ask them to see the archive room. I've seen it three or four times, and every time I walk into the room, I can't believe they've got that much stuff there that people don't see. I'm talking about a room that's floor to ceiling with tapes and papers and writings by some of the earliest people in this fellowship. 3 years ago, they did what is now the archive sampler. It was a weekend of making recordings of some of the oldest living members in this fellowship. Hopefully it'll get out sometime. I wouldn't bet on it. But if you look at the reason I say that, and it's not meant sarcastically, is that 5 years ago, I believe the estimate was, is that simply starting to put some of this material together would cost in excess of $80,000. We just don't have that amount of money. In fact, the original reason that Miracles Happen was printed was in the belief that this book would be scooped up by every addict at the time. They would make huge amounts of money, and this was going to fund the writing of the history. For those who are involved with the literature process at all, they know that didn't happen, and it's simply a part of the inventory now. The money from that book was never set aside because they didn't sell enough initially to create this huge fund they expected. So I believe that's the first thing we can do. On a more personal level, not only do I travel, but what I had to do in my personal recovery is I had to make a shift that to this day, I did 4 years ago, and to this day is still not understood by anybody, and it really doesn't matter to me. And what that is that I come from a relatively small area in Wisconsin. It comprises six counties and has under 30 meetings. Although with very little real driving, you can easily hit a meeting a day. What happened 4 years ago is that, in spite of the fact that I had what for me is a significant amount of clean time, that recovery was still life and death for me. It remains that way on a daily basis. In spite of the fact that I've been here for a while, there are a number of times for physical ailments that I'm dealing with that the use of drugs becomes very attractive to me. Very attractive. And 4 years ago, I discovered that I was thinking of reasons not to go to my home group. In spite of the fact I was driving less than 10 miles to get to this meeting, I would come back from the meeting and in my head was talking about what an unbelievable waste of time it was. Fortunately, I was able to talk about those feelings with my sponsor, who unfortunately doesn't give me answers. Simply keeps me asking questions of myself until I come up with something and still bothers me. But what he said was, if you're not getting what you want where you're going, then the option is to do what? And so 4 years ago, I started going to Milwaukee for meetings. Milwaukee is about 85 miles from where I live. My home group is I'm a Winner Today in Milwaukee on Saturday mornings at 9:30. I get up every Saturday that I'm in the state of Wisconsin, and I mean if I'm anywhere in the state of Wisconsin, I go to my home group. That means that I have been at regional service conferences for the weekend where I've gotten up at 6 o'clock in the morning and driven 2.5 hours to go to my home group. We can do what we can do, what we can do things within our areas to inspire global recovery, because each of us, as I said, has a different globe. It may be the city that you live in. It may be the region that you're part of. It may be the area of the country or the zone that you're in. If you're able to go to other countries, that's wonderful. If you're not, do what you can within the world that you do exist in. The next thing I want to talk about, because, it, like I said, it's very important to me for a number of reasons, is translations. As I said, I run a service office for the fellowship in Wisconsin. And when I started running it almost a decade ago now, one of the first things I started doing was simply buying two copies of every one of the texts that we had in any other language that was available. For years, when I went to conventions, I'd put these books out, but I'd normally put them at the end of a table, and people didn't have a lot of access to them. I also started keeping a set of all the key tags that we had. 3 weeks ago at the Rockford Convention, I had purchased a small table and made it just those things, the books and the key tags. In that one weekend, I sold two of the Just for Todays, nine of the basic texts, and every one of the key tags that there were. And for those of you who don't know, we have the key tags are available in 23 languages. Including the welcome key tag in Chinese. Couple stories I want to tell you about translations, which to me, although I've always known that they were important. Number one, my favorite story about translations. A couple years ago, I was selling literature at a convention in Southern Illinois. And young kid comes up to me. He had to be, to me, most everybody's young, but he was in his mid-20s. And he comes up to the table, and he happened to see the books in all the non-English text, and he pulled out one in Italian, and he says, oh, you have the basic text in Italian. And I said, yes, and he asked how much it was, and I told him. And I said, wow, that's really cool. You speak Italian? And he says, no, I don't. And I said, so what do you want the basic text in Italian for? He says, because my grandmother can't speak English. And I'm getting this basic text to give to her so that she can understand what happened to her grandson, because he had no way of communicating to her the change that had happened. Over the years, I've seen that. I've seen people over and over and over again who have various languages that they either grew up with, that their parents taught them, that they learned early on, who didn't know that we had the basic text in that available language. I've sold basic text in various languages to people who are going to countries and either wanted to bone up on a language that they had learned at one time or simply wanted to get an idea of what the meetings would be like where they were going. On the downside is the fact that in my region, in the Wisconsin region, in both areas and in the region itself, it's sad to say that we sell very, very few translations. And the one that bothers me the most is Spanish. My second convention this year was in mid-January, and it was in Milwaukee. And at that convention, I sold just under $200 worth of Spanish literature, which, considering the level of my sales, is relatively good. The thing was is that $200 at that single convention exceeded the total amount of Spanish literature I had sold for the previous 15 months. And the second problem with that is that literature, the most part, was not destined to be used in the Wisconsin region. It was being purchased by two addicts from Guadalajara, Mexico, who during that weekend discovered that they could buy a Spanish basic text from me cheaper than they could buy it in Guadalajara, which kind of confuses me, seeing a Spanish literature should probably be cheaper in a Spanish language country than it would be in Wisconsin. Third thing I'm going to talk about before I wind up, and I've got just enough time, I think, is the places that I've been able to go to since I've been clean. And to start that, I want to talk, if I can, I shared this the last weekend at a convention, and although I've always been aware of how it affected me, that convention was the first time I actually cried when I talked about it. I'm not real big into crying, and I really don't think I'm there right now. When I came into this fellowship, I came, like all of us, with a lot of baggage. And part of that baggage is the fact that I spent a lot of years in prison. And so when I got here in the very first convention, world convention that there was the year I got clean, was in Australia. And so there were dreams, you know, yeah, I'm going to go, knowing full well that there's no way that I'm going to be able to go to Australia, because at that time I was still on federal parole. The next time I had an opportunity, or when I had an opportunity to go to a convention in France, the idea just appealed to me, and I applied for a passport. When I applied for the passport, I had absolutely no expectation of getting it. 5 months later, I got a letter from the State Department that, by its very size, thickness, I knew wasn't a letter, and was the passport that I was absolutely sure that I would never get. And I sat on my porch in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, with the sun in my face, and held that letter for an hour without opening it, and just looked at the postmark, and looked at the trees, and looked at people around me. And then I opened the letter, and my world changed at that moment. The next day, I made my reservations to go to France, and I did. While I was in France, we traveled around the country. We went to French meetings that I didn't understand a word of, except for I knew exactly what they were talking about, particularly in the readings. I was then able to go to the first convention in Japan, in Tokyo. And outside of Canada, where I've been to a number of conventions, and it's not, I'm not being insulting, but I consider Canada part of the United States in that respect. I mean, there aren't a great deal of differences. And my third big one was when I went to the convention in Cartagena, Colombia. Every one of them involves stories. I could go on and on and on. Every one of them had something that stuck in my mind. Japan, in and of itself, all my life I've heard, if I ever listen, the fact that there's all these Japanese tourists that come to this country and do it on a regular basis and spend all this money and da da da, and I have no idea why. When I was over in that country, I literally could not believe that that was the largest city in the world. I saw no graffiti. I saw no dirt on the roads. I saw sidewalks that are absolutely clean. I drove in taxis that looked like they had been sanitized prior to me stepping in the door. I mean, they had white doilies on the seats. There was no graffiti in the subways. They have a huge, huge subway system there. I could not believe it. They have two of the three largest subway systems in the world are in Tokyo, within five blocks of each other. The fellowship itself is just as polite as the rest of the country. When I arrived 5 days earlier than the convention was going on. The 5 days prior to that is when they hold the Asia-Pacific Zonal Forum. In itself, it's a story. The only thing I'll tell you is that I walked in the room for the Asia-Pacific Zone. The Asia-Pacific Zone includes Hawaii and Australia. Okay? Hawaii and Australia, without telling you that they do this, supports probably 75% of that forum. They literally pay for member countries to come to the forum because they do not have the money. Bangladesh and Pakistan and Korea and to a large or to some extent India does not have the money to fly to the places that they go to or stay at the places that they stay at. When I arrived, my plane landed. There was an attic from Tokyo. Tokyo's 45 minutes away from the airport, easily 45 minutes. Drove out there, picked us up, refused to take any money for the garage, would not allow anybody to pick up their bag and carry it into the dorms where we were staying at Olympic Village. And I came to find out that the particular member who came and picked three of us up had been at the airport for 4 hours waiting for us, had 6 months clean. He had 6 months clean and never questioned doing it. To him, it was an honor to come and pick us up. When I sold at the store, I took some lapel pins and metal key tags with me. I'm a merchandising idiot at heart. And was there for an hour and 55 minutes. And I am also one of those addicts who, in spite of the fact that I'm supposedly disabled, refuses to ask for help and loads boxes. I get to this convention and I've got it set in my head that it's going to be easy for me to do this, right, for this two-hour period. What I found out later is that suddenly there was a member of the Japanese fellowship standing next to me and started helping me unload and looking at the prices and everything. And it took me about 5 minutes to figure out that if he wouldn't have been there, I would have been dead meat. Because converting in your head is one thing when you've got a single person standing in front of you. It's another thing when you've got 14 individuals who only speak Japanese and you're trying to convert to their currency from yours. I later found out that it was the policy of the convention committee that they automatically had a member of the fellowship there if anybody who was not from Japan was selling something. They didn't ask, they simply did it. That was Japan. I'm hopefully going back this year. I missed two because I loved it over there. My memory of outside the fellowship in regards to Tokyo is the fact that I found out, and I went into Tokyo every single day because it was an unbelievable city. I don't know about anybody else, but I do know that if I stopped, I'm, this is me, this is what they said. If I stopped anywhere for 10 minutes, somebody came up to me and asked me if I needed help. Unbelievable country. Next place, as I said, or the, you know, there wasn't much to say about France. I loved it. I love the food. I love the city. I love the people. But it really didn't strike me as too completely different from what it's like in the United States. I mean, they have a relatively good-sized fellowship there. The meetings that I went to, I mean, it was during the World Convention. I understand that, but I was there 4 days before the convention. Meetings I went to had a good number of people. I mean, it appeared that they were strongly supported. The one thing that I do remember is that right now, I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you. Nice sign.
Yeah, thank you.
Now we'd like to introduce our second speaker.
Thanks, Gene. I'm Stan. I'm an addict.
Hey, Stan.
I've really got a lot out of what you shared. And for me, I kind of look at this global recovery thing as one of the themes of our World Convention was is our diversity is our strength. And through traveling to all these different places, I've traveled to plenty of places in the United States, but to be honest with you, I haven't gotten as much from any of the places in the United States I've gotten to is when I've left the United States. And the diversity is our strength. It's really strange or appropriate, I guess would be better, that the theme of our convention is lost dreams awakened, you know. And when I used to use, you know, I had these dreams of traveling to all these places, you know, and those dreams, they were lost. They were lost in addiction, you know. And I use the term, they were just become a pipe dream, you know, and now, by the grace of God and this fellowship, you know, these dreams are awakened and they get to come true. You know, I went to World Convention in Baltimore and they were selling pre-convention t-shirts for Paris, France there. It's my favorite t-shirt, the Outreach, purple Outreach t-shirt, and they could have sold it for twice as much as what they did, and it would have still been a bargain. And I said, I'm going to go to that convention. And a lot of people think that, you know, I make a lot of money, and I really don't. And right here, this is what I buy the vast majority of my airplane tickets on, and this is a quarter that I'm holding up. And I took, at that moment, when I bought that t-shirt in Baltimore, I said, I'm going to go to that World Convention in Paris, France, 14 months later. I never spent any change that I had in my pocket from that point on. I separated all my quarters, and I saved up all the money to buy my airplane ticket to go to Paris, France, and some. And some. And I've gone there and Cartagena, both on quarters. On quarters, just the airplane ticket. MasterCard helped on the rest. But so I went to Paris, and I enjoyed myself. I would honestly tell you that it wasn't the best out-of-the-country convention that I went to, but I enjoyed myself. And one of the main things, really rewarding experiences that I had happen to me when I was in Paris was we went to a regular meeting after the convention was over, and in there was a newcomer girl that came up, and you could tell, I mean, she just came in off the street and picked up a white key tag. And then after the meeting, some people came up and approached us, and we asked if they were going out to eat, and they said yeah, and they got a ride, and we went out to eat. And I'm saying to myself, well, in America, the women would have got with that newcomer girl and not just got her to let her leave. So we show up at the restaurant, and like 5 minutes later, this entourage of women show up, and the newcomer girl is with them. You know, it was like the only thing that was different was the language. And then, you know, when it came time to pay for the check, you know, I tried to tell the person, well, let me give you some money to help for this newcomer's food. And they said, we've already passed the basket and taken care of that, too. And that was really a highlight for me. I went to Cartagena, and I'd been to Florida. I lived in Florida for 12 years. I got clean in Florida, and I said, oh, this ain't going to be nothing. You know, I'm used to tropical climate. And when I opened up that airplane door, and you step out, and you walk down onto the tarmac there and walk into the airport, and it was like Capel. I said, oh, this ain't like nothing that you had ever seen before. And fortunately, I acclimated to it good. But they had a welcoming committee there, the local fellowship, waiting for us when you came out of the airport with like signs with NA logos on it and stuff. And they were like grabbing our bags, going to the cab drivers, like running off the people that were trying to hustle to make, they weren't trying to rip you off. It's their livelihood to try to stand there. And when you're an obvious tourist, see if you can make even like 50 cents to just carry your bags over to a taxi cab or something. But like they were like running them off, and they'd get in a cab drive with us and take us to the hotel, and they, you know, like they'd sit, we'd go out to eat, and they'd watch you eat, and they wouldn't order nothing. And it really became apparent to me that it's like they weren't ordering nothing because they couldn't afford to order anything. And at least this was my experience. And you almost had to like argue with these people to let them buy you some food, you know. And but they had, you know, the same dignity and thirst for this recovery that you know, I had when I came in here, you know, and I was able to take and give it back. I remember when my first time that I had two extra dollars to be able to help somebody, and I was able to say to a newcomer, come on, McDonald's has got like the 2 for $2 deal, and I must have had $2.10, and we went and I got two of whatever it was, and we split it. And I took and went to Turkey a little more than 2 years ago. I saw a thing on World Services website. I go to World Services website and look at the events webpage at least twice a week. And because to be able to do this on a tight budget, I need to plan way in advance. And I saw that they were having, it was turned out to be like a retreat, and it was on this island in off the coast of Istanbul. And it, I couldn't believe the price, because it was like $20 for the weekend, and that included the meals. So I contacted the people, and I went. I just took a leap of faith, and I got on an airplane, and I went, and they told me what to do and where to go and take the shuttle bus to this part of town. Now, you got to understand, Istanbul is like going to like a 3,000-year-old New York City. It is enormous, you know, to go from like what is called Istanbul, from one end of it to the other end of it, could take you a couple of hours, because there's all these, what we would call in the United States, boroughs inside, but it's all called Istanbul. And I get to where I'm supposed to be, and the newcomer that they had sent for me was not there. And I'm panicking, and I use the cab driver's cell phone, and I call my English-speaking contact up, and she says, on the upper level behind the bus station where you're at is a tea garden. Just go wait in the tea garden, and somebody will be there, you know, like within the hour for you. So I go on up there. Now, this tea garden is like about as wide as this room, but it's about a football field long. And they don't have a picture of me. They don't know what I look like. And I'm sitting there. And then after a while, I started to, like, panic again. But I see this sign on this little concession stand with the telephone. I go, well, they must, something with the telephone. So I go on over there, and one thing I've learned with traveling where I don't speak the language is you really get back to some like basic grassroots caveman communication. You can do a lot with your hands, a pencil, and a spiral notepad, and drawing pictures or whatever you have to do. You can get the point across. So the guy figured out I needed help with a telephone call, and I'm standing in there, and I got my NA t-shirt on, which I always, almost always have, and my NA baseball cap, and I'm just getting ready to dial the telephone, and this guy comes around the corner, and he's standing there, and he's looking like this at me, and I'm looking like that at him, and he goes, NA? And I go, NA? And we hugged, and that was it, and I was like, safe. I was safe. And I had a fantastic time. I went and to the retreat. They asked me to speak at the retreat. I was there for like a total of a little more than a week. But what happened out of that was God intervened, and we decided we were going to have last October, the first NA convention in the country of Turkey, and it was also the 10th year anniversary of Narcotics Anonymous for the fellowship. And I want you to know that it's global recovery and it's global service too. You do not have to be anywhere to be a service, because I was an active participant in that convention committee for the entire year planning. I helped with fundraising t-shirts, all different kinds of things. So you can get involved wherever you are. And in the process, what happened was I went over there and I met a female member of Narcotics Anonymous there and got in a relationship, and I fell in love with her. And actually, I wrote a story about this. They published it in NA Way magazine, my whole Istanbul experience. But the long and the short of it is the relationship didn't work out, and she broke up with me last October. I'm still working on getting over that. And I wanted to leave. I like wanted to leave. I was in Greece for the European convention, and I really just wanted to get on an airplane and leave. And I get back to Istanbul, and I go to a local meeting. And by now, I've been back and forth to Istanbul like 6 times probably. I know everybody. I got my little Turkish book. I've taken listen to tapes. I can go around. I can travel. I can do anything I need to do in the country of Istanbul without any assistance. Even argue with the cab driver that was trying to rip me off. And I impressed him so much that he shook my hand in the end when we finally agreed on a price, which wasn't what he wanted and wasn't what I wanted. And we came to a middle ground. And I shared in that meeting how like I wanted to just say, F this convention and the heck with all of this, you know, and like get on an airplane and go back to the United States. And they told me, they said, well, that's fine, Stan, but you know what? This isn't about you, and you're on the convention committee, and we need you to help us put on this convention. We need you to stay here. You're committed to service, you know. And I'll tell you what, if I'd have left and got on that airplane and gone back, I would not have done as well as I did through the whole thing. And through this global recovery, I was able to remain friends with this person. You know, through service, I've been able. She just called me up. I celebrated 13 years this Thursday, and she called me up. We had about a 15-minute international telephone call for her to wish me a happy anniversary. And I want to back up. I went the year after Cartagena. I went to a convention in Rio de Janeiro. I had met a friend in Rio de Janeiro, and it was a big learning experience, a real big growth thing for me in Rio de Janeiro. I learned about not to people please. I learned how to, like, it's okay to say this isn't working. I learned all of this through negative experiences, which made me grow as an individual, because this individual invited me to come stay at her house. We were just platonic friends in Rio de Janeiro. Okay? The problem is that Rio de Janeiro is a city Rio de Janeiro is a state or a province or whatever you want to call it also. And she didn't live in Rio de Janeiro, the city. She lived in Rio de Janeiro, the province, about 50 minutes away from where almost all the meetings are, where like Copacabana that we've heard the song and all of that stuff. And after about 3 days when I saw this was not working because I was too isolated, too dependent on them, I should have said, listen, I really appreciate your hospitality, but I need to be more in town where there's more meetings, and I'm going to go to a hotel room. But I didn't, and because of that, you know, I didn't have as good a time as I could have. But what happened was one night I went to a meeting, and I met this guy that spoke like a very little bit of English, and I got his phone number, and I needed a meeting. I was going through feeling isolated like a big dog, and I needed a meeting, and I called this guy up, and really the only thing he understood was my name and group. That's what they call a meeting there. And he was able to put it together that I want to go to a meeting, and I was able to put it together that, yes, he's going to come and get me. And I call my friend up that I'm staying, who works at the Regional Service Center in Rio de Janeiro, and I tell her what's going on, and I tell her who it's going, and she goes, well, did the lady, the housekeeper, tell him how to get to my house? And I said, no. And she goes, well, I know every single person in our little area that's in Narcotics Anonymous, because she had the most clean time. And she goes, I'm telling you, he don't know where I live. And you're not going to get to a meeting tonight. And I said, well, just have your housekeeper write the address down and call me a cab, and I'll take a cab to the meeting. And she goes, this is a little church up the, you know, it's like, they have streets that, like, you don't even think cars can make it up. And she goes, the cab driver's not going to find this place. Just accept the fact that you're not going to make it to a meeting, and I'll take you to a meeting tomorrow. So I'm, like, laying in my room to the point of tears, trying to let go of this. And all of a sudden, there's a horn honking, and the housekeeper's calling me. And, you know, we say the newcomer is the most important person at any meeting. Well, the night, a few days before, where I got that guy's phone number, there was a newcomer. He picked up a white key tag. Okay. He spoke some English. This guy that I called went and got that newcomer. That newcomer went and got a guy that knew where my friend's house was. And we can do together what I can't do by myself, or in this case, he couldn't do by himself, because they came and they got me. And we went to a meeting, and then they said, you like rock and roll music? And I said, yeah. And they took, I never came home that night. A guy that had just met me said, just come stay at my house tonight. And finally, in the end, in Rio, I said, I'm going to stay in a hotel the last two nights. And I went, to a meeting, and then the meetings in the Rio proper, there were a lot of people that spoke English. And I, like, went to two meetings a day, and I'm getting ready to fly home, and I have, like, 4 hours till I'm going to leave, and I see on the meeting list that there's a noontime meeting, or 1 o'clock, whatever it is, and I says, I'm going to find this meeting. I'm walking down Copacabana Strip, and there's, like, a Gucci store there, and I says, they speak English in the Gucci store. I go on in there, and I says to the guy, this is where I'm trying to go. I show him the meeting list. I says, can you call me a cab and ask the cab driver to take me to this place? He goes, well, I can. He goes, but I'll tell you the truth. He goes, walk one street over and make a left and just go look for the building number. You're 2.5 blocks away from the meeting. So God was there. And I go to the meeting, and I get up in there, and there's, like, nobody really spoke English. One guy spoke, like, a very limited amount of English, and he was sitting in the back with his girlfriend. But, you know, they're going through the readings, and somebody, when it's time, is there anybody from out of town or something like that, they nudge me, and they let me know it's my name, so I identify myself. And there, when you speak or lead or whoever, share, you get up and sit beside the secretary, and all of a sudden, they need somebody to lead the meeting, and they want me to lead the meeting. I says, I don't speak Portuguese. They said, it's okay. We want you to lead the meeting. I go up there. I start talking, sharing about all this anxiety, isolation, talking with my hands like I'm doing right now, and all of a sudden I'm like, I'm just like sharing from, and I'm looking out there, and every person in the meeting is like shaking their head. They like knew what I was saying, and I call that my like cosmic experience. It was like the NA cosmic connection was there. The language was not an issue. It was they could feel me. They could feel me, and they understood what it was by my tone of voice, my facial expressions, my gestures, you know, and it was a beautiful experience. I just now, in January, I went to a convention in Lithuania. I contacted the people. I got there. I had experience quite similar to Gene's Tokyo experience. They get there. I go through immigrations, and there's somebody waiting for me on the other side with a sign with my name. And the person that spoke English had like 6 months clean and had just broke his leg skiing the day before, but he was there because he was the translator. And they treated me like a relative, a distant relative that had finally come back to the motherland or something like that, you know. And I went and I met people from Russia. This girl, 25 years old, she traveled on a train like 18 hours. It looked like it was out of like a World War II movie, the train. We went to the train station to go pick her up. I'll tell you my experience. People overseas, they really got the true definition to go to any lengths. I got such a gratitude feeling for, we got it so good. I mean, the worst place I ever been for a meeting. I mean, I'm sitting in Lithuania. We're in buildings where you can see your breath. It's so cold in the meeting, you know. And the rooms are just jammed up packed. They're jammed up packed. I want to back up for a second. As when I went to Istanbul for this convention, I approached this region and asked them if they would donate some leftover merchandise from previous conventions for me to bring there to give to them to auction off to raise funds for their convention. And I asked friends that I had and stuff, and I brought my limit. I literally brought 120 pounds in NA stuff over there. And I couldn't even bring all that our region gave to us and gave me to bring there. And it helped. It really helped. So I had like 60 more shirts left over, and Turkey said, "What are we going to do?" I said, "Well, it won't be cost effective to ship these shirts." I said, "Why don't you let me take them to the next NA convention that I go to overseas and donate them on the behalf of Turkey?" Because they were CMP Regions t-shirts, but they gave them to Turkey. So now they're Turkey's t-shirts. And I took them to Lithuania, and it was like, they did their convention on a shoestring budget. They didn't have a banner. The only thing that they had was the name tag thing, and the only merchandise that they had was the t-shirts that they said, if we auction them off, everybody won't be able to participate because of the economic statute of the fellowship. And they said, we're going to sell lottery tickets for the t-shirts for a dollar, one of their dollars, a piece. And it like made their convention a success, you know, monetarily. And it takes money to put on conventions. And it made their convention a success. They cleared $131 at their convention, and 91 of it was generated by the t-shirts that originated from our region. So what I'm saying is, if you're going to go overseas to some convention, especially if you know it's one of the first conventions of that fellowship, ask your area, ask your region, ask your friends for some stuff to bring, and just give it to them, and it is really, really appreciated. So I went to that convention, and then I just, like 3 weeks ago or so, maybe a month now, got back from a convention in Saudi Arabia. I went to a convention in Saudi Arabia again. I went to World Services website. I found it, and it was a total God thing. I did not think I was going to get to go. I communicated with them. I'm trying to get a visa to go to Saudi Arabia. I literally had the Saudi embassy hang the telephone up on me in Washington, D.C. And to make a long story short on that, there is no such thing as a tourist visa to go to the country of Saudi Arabia. You have to have a business or an organization sponsor you. And Narcotics Anonymous has a healthy friendship relationship with the biggest oil company in the country of Saudi Arabia. And that's the convention was being held on their complex. And also at the same time, they were having a health fair. The oil company was putting on a health fair, and they had asked Narcotics Anonymous if they would have a PI booth, an NA PI booth, in the health fair. So I got to participate in the very first PI booth ever in the country of Saudi Arabia, and the oil company intervened and petitioned the Saudi government for my visa to come to be there for Narcotics Anonymous in the PI booth. So that was how I got there, and they I told them, I said, I don't think I'm going to be able for to come, the airplane ticket, if I was going to buy the visas myself and all that. They said, you buy an airplane ticket and you get here and we'll take care of you. I'm going to tell you something. They meant what they said. I got over there. There was like the NA Welcome Committee. They didn't let me out of their sight. They made sure that I didn't go without for anything. I never, you know, felt unsafe. You know, the media does not paint, in my opinion. Maybe Narcotics Anonymous don't have an opinion, but I have opinions. And does not paint a true picture of that part of the world. And I felt totally safe. And we're talking about global recovery. And what I got to experience there was such an astounding thing. It's a different culture. It's a different religious background, religious base, and NA can adapt and work anywhere. It's not like they don't have to change for NA. I watch meetings, and when it is prayer time, whoever chooses to pray gets up, leaves the meeting, goes somewhere else, prays. At certain times during the convention, they deliberately did not have workshops going on when they knew it was going to be prayer time. The convention, for all intents and purposes, stopped during prayer time. It like ended, and then they restarted, and NA members would be over like in the corner of the room praying, and who chose not to pray would be standing around drinking coffee and eating and just fellowshipping. And when it was time for the meeting to start back up again, you know, it happened to also be prayer time was over, you know. And it was really, really heartwarming. And in when I was in Lithuania, Gene was talking about translation and literature. Lithuania has just gotten IP number one approved, and correct me if I'm wrong, but when you get IP number one approved, they assist you and they approve the key tags, so you get key tags for your language as soon as IP number one is approved. It's like a criteria. You can't get the key tags first. And I happened to be there when they got the first box UPS'd from World Service Office with the first shipment of IP number ones and the first key in Lithuanian and the first key tags in Lithuanian. And I literally have the first multiple year key tag in Lithuanian that came into the country. They gave it to me, and it's really a treasure for me. I did this PI booth, and we did PI training, and I did like a PI training workshop before the night before, and I did all the typical do's and don'ts, you know, and we had like some skits, you know, when I would throw a question at somebody and then see what their response would be, and some people's response would have not been an appropriate response because it would have started a debate, and we don't really want a debate, you know. And then in the end, because we have cultural differences there, it's all good. It's nothing's bad. It's all good. And I said, now what could happen at this PI booth tomorrow, or what will happen someday, is we're going to be doing PI here in Saudi Arabia, and somebody's going to come up and they're going to say, my sister or my mother or my wife has a problem with drugs, and can Narcotics Anonymous in Saudi Arabia help them? And there are no women in Narcotics Anonymous in Saudi Arabia. And it was like this look of like, oh man, this is for real. This is for real. And what are we going to do? This is for real. And we talked, and they explained to me some things which really helped me, which was, it's not like women aren't welcome at Narcotics Anonymous. It's like women wouldn't be comfortable in a room with men. That's their culture. That's how they're brought up. It doesn't happen. Women wouldn't sit in a room with men and take their veil down and start crying and talk about issues. And so, what are we going to do? And the answer was, well, honesty, you can't go wrong with honesty, is there's no Narcotics Anonymous for women in Saudi Arabia at this time. If your female loved one can and will travel to the country of Bahrain, there's NA meetings in Bahrain that women can come to. And what happens is, through that PI workshop and God, the next day one of the members is at the health fair, and they have an enlarged newspaper article posted on the wall, and there's a female doctor in Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia, and she is opening up a treatment center for women addicts in Saudi Arabia. And we had the PI booth, and we knew what I'm getting goosebumps right now talking about it, to tell you the truth. And we had the PI booth, and they talked about it, and they said that the PI subcommittee is going to get members of NA from up there to go approach the doctor and bring her NA literature and take and let her know that NA is there, available to help them in any way, shape, or form to get NA for women over there. Because in that country, it will be NA meetings for women and NA meetings for men, because that's how the culture is. It's all good. Women can't even drive. It's against the law to drive in that country. So, you know, NA can work. And NA don't have to change. I mean, they don't have to change for NA. NA has to work within the way the culture is, and it can, because our fellowship, our program is so simple, it can do that. The highlight, I had all of this good stuff, but myself also, I went to jail too, and okay, I need to stop now. I'm sorry. I got this one last thing, which is, they got to take me into the federal penitentiary in Bahrain. I got to go to the NA meeting in the federal penitentiary in Bahrain. They have one penitentiary. And let me tell you something. NA has got it going on in there. I forgot to bring my pictures. They let me take pictures of NA in the federal penitentiary. And they don't have like some multi-purpose room like when you're usually in an institution. The church uses it. Other fellowships use it. They got like their own clubhouse in the penitentiary. It's just NA. Everything is NA. Jail art, it's NA. They have three meetings a week in there, and they have all the NA literature, and it was just unbelievable. It was unbelievable. And the guy, that's the secretary, who spoke very good English, took me off to the side, and he said, I want you to know one thing. I go, what's that? He goes, the people that are in this NA meeting are here because we want to stay clean, because you can get any drugs you want in this prison. He goes, and you don't get jail time off your sentence for going to NA. You know, and if you get 30 years there, you do 30 years. You know, so That's my experience, you know. And in closing, I'm going to say this, you know. Take a leap of faith. Do a little bit of common sense footwork. And get yourself a language dictionary and go. And you will have an experience like you will never begin to imagine. Thanks for letting me share.